Hi, I'm Tim.
And I'm Phil.
And this is Terror Tales. We are a weekly podcast show discussing our favorites in horror movies, music, and other melancholy media.
We dive headfirst into the plot, the kills, and so much more.
At the end of each episode, and throughout each recording, we sprinkle in some fun facts about the topic, too.
We can be found on many services like Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more. So turn down the lights, lock your bedroom door, and come get scared with us every Tuesday and Friday.
Hi, I'm Tim.
And I'm Phil.
And this is Terror Tales.
Ooh.
It's been a fucking minute.
Oh, yeah. It's been more than a minute. Like, it's been quite a while since we've been around.
But I'm excited, Phil's excited, and we're back in full swing, everybody. And we have a very special one for you guys today.
Yeah, we're looking into the depths of hell and the mix between pain and pleasure in the movie Hellraiser.
And it's what was supposed to be the next name in horror.
Yeah. This movie is based off of the book The Hellbound Heart by Clive Barker, yes. And he actually used the book to direct the film as well, although there were several changes made from the book.
Yes, like key characters in this story, but that's because of the production company that did this movie. It's not even a business anymore. It's called New World Pictures, and they were the cheapest of the cheap.
Yeah, I bet they were. Like, I'm excited. I'm definitely excited, as Tim is, like he said. I have the book open with me tonight, and I will be commenting on a few different changes that we'll be noticing throughout the story.
Yeah, so we always, you want to start us off, Phil, or you want me to go first?
Go ahead and go first. I want to follow your lead this time.
All right, so first we see a puzzle box, and we hear what seems like a questionable Asian street vendor. That's the best way I can describe him. Mm-hmm. Like, what's your pleasure? And so, guy with dirty fingers puts a wad of money on the table, and the iconic line from that Asian street vendor is, "Take it, it's yours, it always was." And so right after that, we cut to the next frame, and we see the guy in a frickin' circle, well, a square, actually, square of candles, and he might have been solving that puzzle box for hours. It doesn't really give you a good distinction of time.
This is a perfect time to... Oh, sorry, Tim. I was just going to say, this is a perfect time to comment on a difference. In the book, there's actually more detail to the room that our character is in right now. He's got a whole entire altar set up just with offerings like bones, bonbons, meals, and even a whole jug of his urine, product of 7 days of collection.
Yeah.
And one last thing he has prepared is a plate of dove's heads. And in the book as well, he actually gets the box from a man named Kircher, who's a German.
Yeah, I know, and they changed it to, like, Middle Eastern Asian guy. I say it not trying to be disparaging, it's just, that's the stereotypical thing in the 80s of the way that they talked in movies.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, but anyway.
So but he's really sweaty, and so then everything starts to, in the box, starts to move by itself, starts opening up more, and then we start hearing, it's almost like this fucking creepy box wants to be solved.
Mm-hmm.
So our character starts to look around, he starts hearing these noises, but you know, he does a whole paranoid switching around, continues to start solving the box. Then we'll see some blue lights in the background on some baseboards. Eerie fucking tune that sets the tone for what we're about to see. And then lightning emanates from the box once it's finished being solved. Then hooks latch onto our character He screams out in pain. And the next scene that we cut to is like the dirtiest house I have ever seen. Even in a horror film, might I add.
Yeah. One more thing. One thing I want to comment on before we move on. There's actually another difference in the book. Initially, when our character, his name is Frank, by the way. Let's just get that out of the way.
Yeah, I just didn't say it because they didn't say it yet.
Yeah, but just for our audience, spoiler alert, the guy's name is Frank. We learn this in the book immediately. But anyway, when he solves the box, he doesn't immediately get torn to shreds like he does in the movie. In actuality, he's visited by one of the creatures of the Order of the Gash, known as a Cenobite.
Yeah.
It's described that this Cenobite... Let me see. We should have had this ready. Well, actually, it was a quartet of Cenobites that showed up. One of them is got jangling chains on them, on their face, and they ask him, is he ready for the pleasure that... First, they kind of have a discussion with him. They ask about like his feelings of pleasure. Is he... And he tells them that he's had all the mortal desires he can and still feels bored and looking for more. They tell him that they can offer him an unworldly kind of pleasure. And once he says that he agrees to it, he's launched into this cacophony of feelings. He can suddenly see, smell, touch, hear, and taste everything. All of his senses are heightened to the point of where it's almost maddening. Even when he closes his eyes, his own memories come in such a powerful force that he's fighting it and fighting it, trying to stay sane. At one point, the pleasure gets to be too much, the senses get to be too much, and he touches himself and, well, spills all over the floor and falls into it. And then one of the Cenobites that was watching him cuts in and is like, are you done feeling that pleasure? And then after they confirm that, they say, well, let's get this started. And that's where we don't see it in the book, but that's where the actual scene of Frank gets torn apart starts to happen.
Yeah, and then after that, like I said about the dirty house, when we're seeing scenes all around it, we go back to the attic. Hooks are still hanging everywhere. Blood, guts, pieces, and there's a revolving pillar with hooks on, some flesh on it. Mm. And then the pale white woman, which is the Cenobite. I thought it was a woman. But going back on a second rewatch, it was actually our main Cenobite, which was dubbed Pinhead because of this movie. But yeah, in the book, it's the lead Cenobite.
Yeah, the fans dubbed him Pinhead because that was just the most recognizable feature about him.
And Doug Bradley's fucking awesome delivery of every line.
Oh, yes. Like, Doug Bradley plays a wonderful role throughout this movie. He's got amazing acting skills.
Clive Barker told him literally to do less. That's why you don't see him do so much in this entire movie. And it is just the menacing way he talks when he's in the makeup, just the presence he emanates. Oh.
All of this just combines and make a great performance. I especially love I definitely love the way he speaks in the movie and speaks in the movie, just delivering everything so calmly in such a sinister tone.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's got so much menace and like authority in it. You're terrified just watching.
Right.
But as I was saying, we'll go around the see the lead Cenobite walking around. Then, in a big twist of irony, he picks up the puzzle box, puts it back together after resolving Frank's face.
Yeah, you see, we see a scene of the first Cenobite we see, the female-looking one. She goes and looks for pieces of Frank's face and puts them all together. And you can see in the room, you can see all the viscera and gore just hanging out. all over the floor and everything.
But like, you saw the box, all of you, bitch.
Yeah, but when Pinhead solves the box and puts it back together, the room is magically clean again. There's no sign of the Cenobites, there's no sign of chains or gore or any mess. It's just
they're the neatest horror villains ever. So after that, give me 1 second, sorry. The attic is empty, and then we hear a door rattling. A man and a woman are arguing outside. Then when he finally opens the door, from the conversation, it's Frank's brother, which here's another difference that Phil can bring in.
All right, so in the movie, Frank's brother is known as Larry, but in the book, he's actually known as Rory. A fun little bit of research I did before this episode is I watched a video called What's the Difference by a channel called Cinefix, IGN Movies and TV. They previously covered the Hellraiser movie and book and covered some of the differences. But a fun little thing they did with Rory and Larry's names is they just combined them to make it Rary, spelled R-A-R-R-Y.
Yeah, it just made it easier. But apparently, this was their childhood home. And Larry's trying to convince his wife, Julia. I'm just going to start saying names. We'll just get this out of the way.
Yeah, just go ahead and say it and get it done with.
But he's like, yeah, we can move in here. This would be great. Frank's never wanted to get rid of this. He's probably in jail or looking for some money.
Yeah. And he says that he'll, both in the book and in the movie, he says that he'll buy out Frank's share of the house even if he comes around, because because Frank is characterized by his own brother as being a lowlife, a druggie, someone that's always hunting for money, always hounding for more.
And so, yeah, and after he finally talks Julia into moving in there while showing her a tour of the house, they go up to the bedroom where they see this dirty fucking mattress.
In the book, there's no sign of a mattress. It's just an empty room. But it is very dank and disgusting. There's, like, old crappy curtain hanging up over the only window in the room.
It's, like, nailed to the... It's, like, nailed to the windowsill, kind of. I think that's what it was.
Yeah, it's, like, been nailed to the windowsill, showing that there was... That Frank, when he was there, he really was trying to keep the light out.
But, and then while Larry's exploring, he goes and turns the light on in the kitchen. And then you see these maggots, worms. This house probably hasn't been cleaned in 10 years by the state of everything.
Yeah, it looks absolutely terrible. There's food that's just been left to rot. All these insects that have came in and crawling and just making the place so disgusting. It really does appear like nobody's lived there for such a long time. But as we know and have seen already, there wasn't the previous occupant. They have other matters they're attending to now.
And so, yeah, he finally gets, while Julia's actually exploring that little creepy bedroom, she sees pictures of Frank and his sexcapades, which brings back some memories to find out that she was having... Memories. Yeah, so she fucking has an affair with Frank's brother. Oh, Larry's brother. My fucking brain.
Yeah, no, it's okay. Yeah, she has an affair with Larry's brother a week before their wedding. Initially, the movie really kind of shows it as somewhat pleasurable for her, but in the book, it's described with all the happiness and joylessness of rape.
Yeah.
But over time, Julia thinks about it so often that she actually creates positive memories from it and longs for Frank's touch.
Yeah, and like we see the scene, and it actually had to be cut by the MPAA because apparently during this scene in the movie, they had to take out a few spankings and some sodomy stuff. It was for a movie in 1987. This was just close to softcore as it gets.
Yeah. And an especially touching part is the fact that they had sex on Julia's wedding dress.
In the book. not in the actual movie. That's another difference.
Yeah. Forgot to mention that. Yes, that is another difference. They actually have the scene of Julia and Frank having sex is on her wedding dress a week before the wedding.
And like, if she's so unhappy with Larry, why just go through with it?
Well, I think it's because she initially was happy with him or rationalized that, you know, some people find people that even though they're not completely compatible, they'll make it work because divorce is seen as a bad thing or a thing to be shunned about. So even if she probably liked Frank more at the time, she went through with Rory because Larry, I mean, because of the stigma of divorce. I got what you're saying.
What it was, and I think it's a difference that's actually happened in the book, because I read at least half the book. What happened was is that he came for the wedding but didn't show up for the actual service after that.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, so she was left with no choice but to marry Larry because she was already there.
Yeah,
Frank was gone, nowhere to be seen.
As usual for his character, he's very flighty in these situations and only really cares about himself.
He doesn't want to be in a relationship. He wants to go for the next, well, fuck.
He wants to keep pursuing pleasure. He doesn't want to be tied down by anyone. And that's basically what he does.
Yeah, he'll be boring if he did. He thinks it's boring if he does that.
Yes.
So... But right here, then, it's that the phone rings, and Larry gets a phone call from his daughter, Kirsty, which is our third main character.
And here's another fun little change from the book. In the movie, Kirsty is known as Larry's daughter, but in the book, she's actually known as Frank's old friend and a
jilted lover.
Yeah,
a friend zoned lover.
Yes, a friend zoned lover, but she's very caring of Rory/Larry, and frequently comes to his house to come visit him. Julia, though, isn't the biggest fan of her. She kind of sees her. She just doesn't really meet. They don't really see eye to eye, or even have any sort of friendly relationship with each other.
Because in the book, Julia is described as a beautiful woman who just thinks her shit don't stink.
Indeed. And Rory is absolutely infatuated by her, but only keeps Kirsty around as a friend. Which, if I were in her shoes, I wouldn't even be there. Like, I wouldn't put myself through that. But
especially, like, moving into a house with them? That's just a...
I don't believe she's moving into the house with them, actually. It's just that she's helping out, but it's never revealed where she lives,
because the way the whole book is pretty much set, it's three people in a house. It's roughly, because like in the book they don't go anywhere but the house.
Yeah, there's some other scenes involving the hospital, which is also something we find in the movie that we'll talk about that later on, but for the most part the book is really set around the house that everybody interacts in.
But yeah, so, and Kirsty was calling her dad to say that she got settled in, and he's like, just come move in with me, it'll be all fine. She's trying to have a level of independence.
Mm-hmm.
It never says really what she does, except for later in the movie where one job she has, but other than that, and then we know from just these phone calls and later in the movie, her and Julia, just like in the book, do not get along.
Yeah, for some reason, there's just a real level of, tension.
Stank.
And tension between them that just never really gets addressed. It's just kind of there.
So after that phone call, then we go into another scene where it's movers, and Larry's trying to help them get a mattress upstairs. And then Julia comes up, and they're trying to, like, pretty much just eye fuck her the whole time.
Yeah, they're just ogling her like she's a piece of meat.
And then they say, "Oh, go get us a beer," and she doesn't say anything, just gives an icy fucking stare, and Larry's like, "I'll do it. I'm not doing anything." I laugh at that scene every time.
Yeah.
But then she goes back and she's still looking through those pictures, and she's still trapped in the memory of the lust with Frank. I'm gonna get that fucked up the whole episode.
Yeah.
And that's all that's happening the whole time. But while she's in the middle of those memories, we get into Larry cutting his hand on a nail that's hanging out way too fucking far.
Now, here's another change from the book. In the book, he actually cuts his hand using a chisel, but the same delivery happens. He runs upstairs to the room that Julia's in. He asks her for help as he's bleeding profusely, and he gets blood on the floor.
Yeah, and she puts, she finally gets out of her memory, and then she, Kirstie's coming through, and then Buck and the Movers are doing the same thing to her. And they say something very insensitive, like, "She's got her mother's looks." And then Larry looks at him and says, "Her mother's dead."
But and, to comment back on the blood real quick,
when
it does drop into the floor in the movie, it just drains right into the wood as if it's just soaking right in. But in the book, it acts the blood
like
mixes
a drop.
It's like a couple drops. The blood mixes in with the dried semen that was left by Frank way earlier before, and it all just soaks into the wood.
Surprised this dude didn't get AIDS with how much his bodily fluids were everywhere. But I was mixing up. I want to mention that because I accidentally, with the thing about Kirstie and all that, she came before he cut his hand.
Yes, she was there before his hand got sliced up.
So then after Larry cuts his hand and the blood seeps into the floorboards, she's the one that takes him to the hospital while Julia is just sitting up there still out of her fucking mind.
Mm.
And then after she leaves the attic also, we get one of the best resurrection scenes in an 80s horror movie. And the way that they do this horror scene, it's not stop motion. It's not like, you know, claymation and stuff like that. What they do is that they have, you know, like the corpse doll or whatever to the makeup team.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just doing it in reverse so that it looks like it's coming back up.
Yeah, they created a special prosthetic for this and filmed it with everything melting, all the flesh coming off of it, everything falling to pieces. And the trick
and it looks...
used...
Sorry.
Just to reverse the footage to make it look like every Frank was piecing himself back together. In the book, we don't actually get this. We just learn later on that at some point Frank revives.
Yeah, so this was actually the last thing filmed after they were already over budget.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good thing they filmed it because it really gives more of a, like, gives more power to the movie in a sense, because
it adds flavor to a gruesome already horror scene, a horror movie.
Yes, exactly.
Because without this would not have made this movie would have been like great, but this just adds that icing to the cake.
Mm-hmm.
So, but after that. And then Julia's looking uninterested. They were having a dinner party. I was getting a little ahead of myself. They were having a dinner party. Julia's down there just looking uninterested while Larry and all of his friends are talking. Kirstie's flirting with this vanilla dude, is what I will name him, but his name's Steve. I just call him Vanilla Steve.
Yeah, Vanilla Steve is kind of boring in the book as well. I think he's into, like, model trains, from what I remember.
Lame! I'm just kidding. But they're having that time. Julia's like, "I'm not feeling well. I want to go lay down." And Larry's trying to get her to stay, but she just goes, and then everybody's still having a good time. Kirstie's been drinking a lot, so she will eventually go upstairs in a minute, but I I'm getting ahead of myself. Sorry. Julia goes back up to the attic to think more about Frank because she can't get him out of her head. And then that's when we get a jump scare. The jump scare where Frank is reaching out to her, and then you see a little skeleton thing crawling at her, which we find out that's a child in a suit. Because there's three actors that play Frank. I don't remember all their names right now. I should have wrote that down. But there was the first time you see it is the kid in the skeleton costume. The voice is an actor because the guy who played Frank for the actual like flesh scenes, he was a British actor who his accent was really thick.
Right.
So he's dubbed over by the guy who plays Skinless Frank for the whole movie.
Right. Just to cut back for a minute, that guy that I said, Vanilla Steve, is actually a cat breeder in the book, not a model training enthusiast.
Even worse.
Yeah, I know, because he really waxes. He waxes on the Kirsty in the book. It's pretty funny. And there's. But anyway, since we're talking about the book, this scene where Julia learns about Frank being alive again happens here as well. Except it's not so. She doesn't really see his body. She feels his presence in the room, and he weakly replies to her, Julia, blood. Like, just those sorts of things. Or, let's see. He says, Julia, it's Frank, and blood. Those are the words that he says, trying to get Julia to understand that he needs blood to come back to life.
And explains that Larry's blood is what brought him back to life.
Mm-hmm.
And he's asking her for help, and she's just, oh no, 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 what the fuck? Pretty much. And
her mind out.
Goes through an entire like freak out, which, you know, I would too if there's a fucking skeleton in my attic. And
go ahead.
So, and then Kirsty, as I was saying, Kirsty was drunk, so she's going upstairs to go to the bathroom. And then she just sees Julia just standing really creepy at the top of the stairs and asks if she's okay, which is weird, out of character. And then Vanilla Steve says, I thought we lost you. And then she goes right back down to the fucking party. And that's when Julia goes back to talk to Frank some more.
Yeah. From the scene that I discussed from the book, she only has one little encounter with Frank where he tells her about what he needs, and she's just left to think this over, and I'm really struggling with the word to decide what to do.
More or less, she's contemplating his offer to help, and with all the memories that have been stirred up since she moved in that house, so she's like deliberating and really thinking about it. And so, but after that, she'll go and say that she needs some time to think about that. We see Kirsty and Vanilla Steve leaving from the party, and they're walking to a dingy subway where they do like just a cheesy back and forth flirty thing, and then they kiss in that subway. And I think right there is a good time for us to cut for our first ad break, and we'll be right back.
All right, see you then.
We're back.
Welcome back, Terror fans. We're happy to be back. We've had a refreshment. We've went to the bathroom. We're ready to go.
Yep. We're now ready to talk more about Hellraiser 1.
All right. So from where we left off, Kirsty and Vanilla Steve were at the subway kissing, and then they left each other. But now we cut back to Julia, who's awake in bed by next to Larry, having nightmares. She's still thinking about Brother Frank and the way he touched her and the way he caressed her.
He touched her no-no squares.
Indeed he did. And then she goes after the nightmare, she gets up out of bed and she goes to the room where Frank is in waiting for her, and she tells him that she comes to the realization that she's going to help him and tells him so. In the book, she kind of comes up with this on her own without talking to Frank, because he's not completely there to have a... It's more like he lives in the walls, just kind of there, but he's not fully present. But she tells him that she's going to help him and kill people to give him the blood he needs to come back.
Yeah, it's, like I said, the differences are surprisingly few and far between, because, well, being Clive Barker wrote the book and the screenplay.
Yeah. Like, he definitely switched things up for the movie, which is surprising. I would figure he would use more of the book to really...
Be like Stephen King.
Yeah, but...
Anytime Stephen King's stuff is made, like, Stephen King will still say to this day, he does not like Kubrick's version of The Shining.
Right.
So it's... Some authors are very protective of their work, which is understandable. They wrote stuff. They spent the time to write it.
Mm-hmm.
It is to be noted, though, that Clive Barker didn't start writing until he was, like, 35.
Well, I mean, it's never too late to write, as long as it's what you want to do.
But he was a playwright before he made the first books of blood.
Yeah, before he wrote The Hellbound Heart. Anyway... We cut to Kirstie having her own set of nightmares with a lot of pillow fluff. She sees a crying baby and a bloody bed that has her father in it. She's scared enough to where she wakes up and calls her dad, Larry, and asks to make sure he's okay, which he does confirm that he's all right. In the book, this is about the same... I was thinking of another scene, so there's not actually anything here. That's just me.
It's okay.
But anyway, so Larry sits on the stairs after this, real creepy, like, while Julia finally goes out and starts looking for her first victim to hunt. She goes.
Yeah, and horribly. She just sits in a little high end looking bar with sunglasses on.
Yeah, she her first victim in the book, and probably the same thing in the movie, is a large set man who's very, well, bulky, let's put it that way.
And she too much motto for the way he looks.
Oh, yes, way too much. He basically, he flirts with Julia a bit, and she brings him back to her place, and she brings him up to the bedroom that Frank is in and gets him to strip down. But while he's doing that, she promised him they'd have sex on the floor in the book and probably have sex on the bed in the movie. But as she's getting him to strip down, she walks over to where Frank's jacket is, that he left it in the room, and pulls out a knife. It's a hammer in the movie, but it's a knife in the book. But anyway, in the book version, she goes and stabs this man several times, but not before he actually fights back. So she actually struggles a bit with this one, this first kill, but eventually stabs him enough to where he's done nothing but gurgling and blubbering until he dies. And then the book describes how Frank sucks the energy from the body, just like a vacuum. He's sucking up all the nutrients.
Don't look at me.
Yeah. But in the movie, you obviously see Frank's half apart body come up to the dead body, and he's like, "Don't look at me," to Julia, and she leaves the room as he begins feeding.
He has a really body issue, because for half of this, during his resurrection, he's like, "Don't look at me."
Yeah, but I mean, think about it. If you're nothing but like blood and flesh like that, I wouldn't want to be looked at either.
Right. Yeah. It's funny, because you wouldn't think he's vain with the creepy shit he's done beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, then when you come back in the room, when Julia decides to walk back in, you just see like this bloody stump, pretty much, where the guy's clothes is still there for what he's still wearing.
Mm-hmm.
But Frank has pretty much put him down to the marrow and blood.
Yeah, in the book, it's just described as a shriveled up body.
Yeah, you know, the visuals in this movie are just top notch.
Gorgeous, even. And as Julie comes in, she sees Frank has, in a sense, leveled up. He has legs again, so he can walk around. But he tells her that he needs more blood. He needs more energy to recreate himself.
And then he puts on that swag and says that I need more so we can be together.
Yeah, and then he goes to try to touch her, but Larry comes home soon afterwards. So she has to hide the body while Frank disappears into the shadows.
Into the bathroom that she goes into to get the blood off.
Mm-hmm. Even in the book, it's very descriptive. Like, she washes her hands off, but she's still got blood on her blouse. And she takes it off at first, but then puts it back on later, and Rory Larry is unsuspecting completely of what happened.
Super oblivious.
Yes.
But that's love. Love will do things to you.
Oh, yeah. That was crazy.
In the movie, she says that I'm not feeling well. Make me a brandy.
Yeah. So, in the movie, we cut from the interaction with Frank and Julia to a pet store where Christy works at. She's having quite a difficult time because a homeless guy has wandered in and started eating crickets.
It's gross.
Oh, yeah, it's very gross. And soon after, the boy in Vanilla Steve shows up, our little cat breeder. But we don't get this scene in the book. It just moves on from there.
It's just so terrible because we can only describe him as Vanilla, because there is nothing to this character. And I mean,
we can describe him as a cat breeder.
Yeah, but you think, in the movie, they didn't do much.
Oh, yeah.
And it is awful, but yeah, then after she's having that issue with the homeless guy, she sees him out after Vanilla Steve comes, and then give me 1 second. I messed up for a second, but pretty much after that, give me one. I'm sorry.
We're having some technical difficulties tonight, guys. No.
So after that, we cut to Julia, where she's getting victim number two.
Well, before we move on from that, I have to. There's another thing in the book that the movie leaves out here. There's a whole scene of Kirsty calling and speaking with Rory. Rory's actually kind of suspicious about the fact that Julia has been less loving with him and talking to him, and she doesn't really want to leave the house. And Kirsty gets put up to trying to go talk to Julia.
Yeah. And they're having, you know, dinner, and he says, yeah, well, you go check on her when you get a chance, and as I said, we cut to victim number two while Kirstie's walking up to check on Julia.
Yeah.
After a very long walk to show us that this is Brooklyn, London, because that's what they never say where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, American cinemas wanted to put it like it was in America. And, well, Clive Barker is British. A good couple of the actors in this movie are British.
Yeah. In the book, we actually see that Julie is at the bar again looking for her second victim. It's a man with a white tie, but she immediately dismisses him because he's too big and too strong, she says to herself. But in, but it's been raining today, and she's worried about the time of Rory getting home, so she's like, okay, you know what? Screw it. Let's take this guy. And
then we see Kirsty walks up to the front door. Well, she's actually across the street by, like, some shrubbery or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
She sees Julia's looking around to make sure nobody's watching, and then makes eye contact with her while that guy is walking into the house.
Right. And she takes the man upstairs and basically does a repeat with the first victim, but she's quicker this time. She actually gets him in more vital spots to make sure that he doesn't fight back as much.
And then Kirsty comes upstairs after, and she goes to talk to Julia, and then that man runs out of the attic room.
Yeah, he's running out trying to get help, but in the book version, Frank gets to him and actually snaps his jaw off before he's able to talk at all.
Damn.
Oh, yeah.
I get that.
Oh, yeah, dude, it was great. Like, and then there's just a whole scene between Kirsty trying to remember who Frank is, and by the time she realizes and recognizes his voice, he's already caught her and dragged her into the room with him. She's stuck between him. He's pressing up on her very lewdly and very sexually. He even says to her in a creepy tone, "Come to daddy."
But yeah, like it's so creepy. Even with the American actor who played Frank's voice for this whole movie is like, "Come to daddy." It's so creepy.
Yeah, it's played so well, and it's specially emphasized in the book. But Kirsty fights him off because she doesn't want any of that. Especially so,
throw things at Frank while trying to run away, she picks up the puzzle box.
Mm-hmm.
That's when Frank starts getting skittish.
Yeah, in the book, she actually fights him a bit more than you see in the movie. First, she hits him with the box, and then she gets stuck down by him again. But he notices that she has the puzzle box in her hand, and he's like, "Give me the box."
Yeah, and then she's like, "You want it? You can fucking have it." And then she throws it out the window and then runs downstairs, goes out the front door, picks up the box, and all you hear is Frank, "No!"
Yeah. And in the book, at this point, after the first person she comes across holding the box, she just kind of faints. And the next scene afterwards, we find her in the hospital.
And then find out that she wakes up. She's like, "I want to leave." And they're like, "You can't leave. You have to sign these papers."
Right.
And then finds the freaking puzzle box just sitting there. She gets curious, like everybody else does when they see this box. Fucking morons. And starts to solve it.
Another key difference from the book is that initially when she wakes up, she doesn't actually have the puzzle box next to her. It's one of the doctors that comes in and brings it to her, saying that they found her with it. And
they do that in the movie, too. It's like he pulls it out of his lab coat thing, puts it right
there.
A little thing next to her.
Yeah, and she's so bored by her own scenery, she has nothing to look at. But, excuse me. She has nothing to look at but bare white walls, so she gets to the point where she's like, "Fuck it, I'm gonna play with the box."
And here's where the fuckery happens.
Yeah, she solves the box using some... Initially, she doesn't know how to solve it. In the book, it describes that the box is, like, perfectly sealed and there's no clues to how to open it, but there's actually some blood stains on it showing just little cracks and crevices that clue her in on how to solve the box.
Yeah, and then she does that, and then she gets to see this really creepy roving monster.
That's another difference from the book, is that there's no monster. When she solves the box, she's just immediately confronted by the lead Cenobite. They're demanding that since she solved the box, unknowingly calling them, she's still responsible and still has to be taken. but like the movie, she convinces them that they're about Frank, that she knows he's alive and she can get them to him. Lead Soundbite tells her, if you can get him to confess, then maybe we won't tear your soul apart.
He's like, we will tear your soul apart. It's so, as we were saying, it's fucking menacing. Mm-hmm. But it's, all the other Cenobites are like, they're over here saying all these things, but like, you gotta go through a whole thing as he's talking about how, like, we are angels to some,
demons
to others.
I think it was demons to some, angels to others.
And then the female Cenobite is just won her head already. And that's another thing that's disgusting looking.
What's that?
Got her like her fucking throat's all hanging open and shit.
I love that. It's very reminiscent of a gash. Like, I like the way that she's got her piercings going through her cheeks, and then you have this giant opening in her throat. It's very distinctive.
Yeah, and she's over here against about Frank, and she's saying that we just want to kill you, and then Pinhead's like, no, nobody escapes us. You get him to confess, and maybe we won't tear your soul apart.
Yeah. So after this, Kirstie finally leaves the hospital and returns to the house. At the time, she's worried about Larry, or Rory in this case. Or Rory.
Yeah.
Rory Larry. You know, I'm calling him Rary at this point. I'm tired of trying to differentiate.
Yeah.
Okay, so she's worried about Rary, so she goes back to the house. She comes to the house and she sees that Rory is there, and he tells her that everything is okay, that he knows about Frank and that they killed him.
Julia told me everything.
Yeah. Now this gets
She's not concerned.
She goes into a panic because all of a sudden, Frank's dead. That's no good. I already promised that Frank's soul would be, or I would lead the Cenobites to Frank. So, throughout the book, she describes that there's a tolling of bells, which I should have mentioned that too. Every time that the puzzle box is being played with, there's this tolling of bells and the screams of birds.
Yeah, it's more or less, it's like, you know, how every horror villain has their iconic theme, like, you know, with Jason is ha-cha-cha-cha-cha. Well, Freddy's got like yeah, it's all of them, and Michael Myers the den 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 den
den den den den den den den den den
den den den
den den den den den den den den den den den den den den den den den den den den den den Kirstie goes upstairs and goes to the room, and she sees that there is a dead body there that's basically nothing but like red flesh and muscle and bone and dressed up in bandages.
Yeah, and we see that Rory, whatever you want to call him, he's looking at like this gash looking thing, or his skin's very loose on his forehead, and that's where we know that something's amiss.
Yeah, Kirstie doesn't completely believe this as quote unquote, well, no, now it's ruined it. Now that Larry comes up and tells her everything's okay, and then he recites this line, come to daddy.
That's what she knows.
She knows something is wrong. And so she basically tries to get away from him. In him grabbing her, she scratches at his face and cuts into the skin that's on his face, cuts into his skin, actually tearing some of it off, revealing the red meaty flesh underneath.
Yeah, and it's... Yeah. And that's pretty much mentions that it's Frank.
Yeah, they get into they're in a big fight and he traps her again, like, saying that he's going to punish her. And then she finally gets her to reveal that he's Frank Cotton. And basically, that's when Cenobites appear.
And put more hooks in him. And they changed this line, but the actor did. And what he said instead, I don't remember what he was actually originally supposed to say that was in the script, but the actor who played Larry, he said Jesus wept right before they tore him apart, which that was perfect.
Yeah, we have a similar scene in the book. After the Cenobites appear, Kirstie breaks away from Frank and tries to run away. He's after her, but just as she's getting out, he's stopped by something. She sees that he's got chains bursting out of his chest. There's thorns in his arms, in his face, cheeks, and he just gets pulled back into the room and torn to pieces. The Cenobites tell her to leave.
Yeah, and then after when she's leaving, guess who shows up? Vanilla Steve Catfucker. Yeah. And then they go out and they see that homeless guy. And he's sitting there in a fire because she threw the puzzle box into the fire. And then he turns into this like skeleton dragon looking thing.
And the box returned to the original vendor being sold to somebody else. What we didn't mention just now was there actually a difference between the movie and the book. In the book, Kirstie's told to leave, and she gets away scot-free with the box suddenly being in her possession again for her to take care of. But in the movie, the Cenobites come after her, and Julia was killed previously by Frank at some point.
That we did. It was actually right before she went upstairs and Frank trapped her. We did totally bypass that.
Yeah, we skipped that. My bad. But then the Cenobites start trying to catch her, and she uses the puzzle box in the movie. She uses the puzzle box to send them back to where they came from. But in the book, she just escapes the house with the puzzle box in her possession, and she's now basically the new keeper of the puzzle box. She tells herself that if there's other boxes, like she looks at the box at one point and she sees the faces of Frank and Julia inside it, knowing they went to hell, but she doesn't see Rory's face, meaning that he may have went elsewhere, maybe to heaven. And she secretly hopes that there's other boxes like this one that would lead to Rory's soul. But in this final line that I want to share from the book, it really describes how she feels towards the end. But if it failed to show itself, she would not grieve too deeply, for fear that the mending of broken hearts be a puzzle neither wit nor time had the skill to solve.
Ooh, that is a very good line to go out of it on.
Yeah, I love that. That was it was a very different ending from what I was expecting.
And so that, our Ghouls and Ghoulies, is Hellraiser 1, released in 1987.
Directed by Clive Barker. Now, what's your final thoughts about this one, Tim?
So when I first watched this, I was like, I had been about 7 or 9. I couldn't watch it until I was almost an adult. And then when I did watch it, I'm like, this is way worse than any of those Friday the 13th movies where, you know, all they were just a gore fest for an entire decade.
This was more of like a thriller than anything.
The sins of the flesh is roughly what the whole story is about.
Yeah, the pursuit of pleasure beyond moral realms.
Yeah, like Frank being, well, a masochist.
Mm-hmm.
He got way more than he bargained for, and they are obviously, they are made to fulfill those needs, but not in the ways you'd expect. It's almost like choose your own adventure story.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, I think, and we'll, like I said, we will be doing, our next one will be the second one, because they are pretty much just one story.
Mm-hmm.
But if we do decide, or our fans decide for us to do any more than that, you'll just notice that
you'll notice more of the disconnect that you'll notice more of the disconnect from the original story as the movies went on. They became direct to TV and VHS and DVD.
Because unfortunately, we all know this, that it always comes up to a rights grab, which was one of the reasons why, for the longest time in the Halloween franchise, where we just got these ones just put out every couple of years or so, so they can keep the rights. It happens with Hellraiser, and it just changes so much. But I love this one. I love the first two more than anyone in the series. I'll always admit that. And I really enjoyed watching this one again for us to do here on Terror Tales to tell our viewers how much we love this movie.
That's awesome, man. I love that. Do you want to close this out with some fun facts before we go?
We were going to do one more little... we'll be right back with my fun facts. It's what we were going to do is do one more ad break, try to get some ads going, because we only put one in here. So yeah, we will do that, and then we'll be right back.
All right, we'll be right back, ghoulies.
With my fun facts.
Timmy's fun facts. Fun facts. Facts. Facts.
Welcome back, everybody.
Thank you. It's good to be back. Now, we're here to display our fun facts and then wrap up the episode. Sorry, I have a little
technical difficulty here.
Man, this episode is nothing but technical difficulties.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right. Sorry. I had a little bit of technical difficulty, but I'm ready and I'm back. We're ready here for some fun facts behind the scenes of this movie.
All right, lay them on me, brother.
Okay, so the first one was, and this one's great. It's during a post-production party when filming had ended. Doug Bradley was dismayed to be ignored by the other cast members of the crew. He thought that he'd gotten on rather well with the cast and crew, and it wasn't until later that he realized that none of the crew actually seen him without his makeup on while playing Pinhead, and therefore, they didn't know who he was.
Well, that's actually kind of funny. Like, imagine everybody knows you as Pinhead, but nobody knows you outside the makeup.
So, yeah, you feel awkward at the rap party.
Yeah.
This one's going to make you laugh a little bit, but it's like when Clive Barker first showed the film to his mother, she cried tears of joy upon seeing her son's name in the opening credits. He leaned over, whispered in her ear, and said, "This is the happiest you'll be for 2 hours."
That's great.
It was that one made me laugh when I first looked at it. And then another one, here's a good one. It's the Chatterer and Butterball Cenobites, which we didn't really discuss them because
there wasn't really much like Cenobite action going on with those two in general, and they're not even really mentioned in the book either.
In the original script, because their makeup made it just coherent speech was not possible. Their lines were given to the female Cenobite, and especially Pinhead.
Yes.
Which helped obviously cement his reputation as the film's trademark character. So, and the next one is, the film was originally supposed to be called The Hellbound Heart, obviously after the novella it was based upon. The studio decided the title sounded too much like a rom-com and asked Clive Barker to change it. Barker offered Sadomasochist from Beyond the Grave, which they obviously rejected for overtly sexual content. He ultimately opened the floor to the production team and they offered their own suggestions, prompting a 16-year-old female crew member to offer up What a Woman Will Do for a Good Buck. Wow. Could you imagine if that was the fucking title?
No, I don't think I could. That sounds so pornographic.
That's probably why they changed it.
Yeah, I'm glad that they stuck with Hellraiser in the end, but The Hellbound Heart would have been a great title.
So here's another one, and this is actually what I was talking about when the guy who played Larry had changed the line.
Mm.
The scripted line was "fuck you," but then he actually went with "Jesus wept," which makes that scene so much better.
Oh yeah.
And so, because of his eventual skill at the application and removal of the pinhead appliances and costume, Doug Bradley has been credited in some of the Hellraiser films as an assistant makeup artist.
Oh, yeah?
Here we go. So that thing I was talking about, how the MPAA made them cut a couple things.
Mm-hmm.
There was some of the hammer blows that were actually cut down to not look so graphic. Fingers entering flesh, obviously Frank. And some of the spanking between Julia and Frank and some of the thrusts in that sex scene were actually dialed down so that the MPAA wouldn't, you know, just put it to an X rating.
Right.
It takes 6 hours to apply that makeup on Doug Bradley. That's fucking... I cannot sit in a chair for 6 hours with somebody touching my face.
Yeah, that's definitely challenging for many actors that go through these for monster movies as well.
And as you were mentioning about the order of gash, the term Cenobite is just the word meaning a member of a communal religious order. They're called Hierophants. In that same thing.
Right.
Here's one. The studio had planned on casting stuntmen as Cenobites to save on production costs. Clive Barker, however, insisted on hiring actors, reasoning that even if the characters did not speak and appeared under heavy makeup, their body language would still convey a personality. Which, he was right. If Doug Bradley wouldn't have done everything that Clive Barker told him to do, this movie would not be what it was.
Yeah. That's interesting.
So the budget of the movie was $1 million, like when we did the first Nightmare movie.
Mm-hmm.
And this one earned $20,000. And Clive Barker had only directed 2 short films before doing that movie. So that would, you know, cement him as a director, a good director for the rest of his life.
Yeah, definitely. He's one of the horror legends, as he's known.
Yeah, just like, you know, we got Chucky, we got Michael, we got Jason, Freddy, and Scream, Ghostface is in there too.
Yeah.
So here's one that I don't understand, but I think you might understand.
Okay.
When he read the script for the first time, Doug Bradley stated that he saw Pinhead as a cross between Oscar Wilde and Noel Coward.
Well, I can't really say that I recognize the other one, but I'm aware of Oscar Wilde.
I am too, but not like enough to understand the cross reference.
Yeah, same, unfortunately.
So give me 1 second. Oh, so in about 1 hour and 8 minutes into the movie, Butterball says no more than a few hissing noises, but he was originally going to say the line, "perhaps we prefer you," in the original script, but like I said about the faces, the lines went to the female Cenobite.
Mm.
I'm gonna butcher this one because I don't really know this word, but the flesh exposed on Pinhead's chest was redesigned as rhombus in honor of Pinhead's master, the fictional character Leviathan.
Right.
Here's one that'll kind of throw you off, because if you didn't like Ashley Lawrence, who played Kirstie, Jennifer Tilly had actually auditioned for that same role.
Wow, really?
Yeah, I don't know if I would have seen that the same, because I've seen her in the Chucky films, and that's really all I could see.
I see.
Clive Barker was pulled over for a broken taillight. The officer asked for his license and registration, saw his name, and started talking about his career. That's just a little fun Fun fact. Comedian Louis C.K. jokes that people should have solved the Hellraiser puzzle before being allowed to text when drunk. That's fucked up.
That's funny.
Alright, so I'll do one more and then we'll be done for this one. It's Doug Bradley describes Pinhead as stronger than Jason Voorhees and Michael Myers.
I could believe that. I mean, you have telepathic power to just use chains and configurations. It's like the
same thing with Freddy, how you wave your hand and you can just tear people apart.
Yeah.
So, and that right there, everybody, is my fun facts. And I hope you guys enjoyed all of our episode. Glad to be back. Sorry it was so rough, but...
Yeah, we'll do better on the next one, but... In the next episode, we're going to be covering Hellraiser 2, a continuation of the original story. So,
yeah, you can pretty much put this almost as like a 4-hour movie, roughly.
Right.
So, but we decided to do them separately because they were released separately.
Yeah, so we're going to do it that way anyway.
We will see you guys next week.
So, until then,
I'm Tim.
I'm Phil.
And this was
Terror Tales. See you later, everybody.
See everybody next week.
Hi, guys. I'm Tim, the other half of the Terror Tales podcast. And I'm coming to you at the end of this episode to give you all of our social medias. We have a Terror Tales Facebook. We have a All for None Facebook. We have a That News Guy Facebook. We have an Instagram for all three, and we have a Nerd Lab Media YouTube channel where we upload all of our newest episodes. So come join us every week on Tuesdays for TV Tuesdays, Thursday for That News Guy, Friday for Terror Tales, and Sunday for All for None. Come join us.